I think
we are pretty much on time, so let's start and have a great time. So the whole idea is the pricing, and the problem is that when freelancers start up their businesses, they go out and they check what others in their industries charge. And so just go out and see what others in their industries charge and say, okay, everybody in my industry charges between, I don't know, $20 an hour and $40 an hour. I charge, I'm a newcomer, I stay low, I start at 20, and over time I will raise it. Now, where does this come from? In 1848, an extremely brilliant gentleman called Karl Marx, although everyone who grew up in communism, just like me, curses him for life, because I think he was a raving idiot, but hey, I had first-hand experience of his theory. And so him and his mate, Friedrich Engels, came up with the Communist Manifesto, and he stipulated the labor theory of value. So his idea was that value is the amount of social labor accumulated in a product or service. So if you have a piece of diamond and a piece of rock, let's say 500 feet in the ground, and you bring both up on the surface, the diamond and the piece of rock are worth exactly the same because it took the same amount of labor to bring them up. Now try to sell this idea to a jeweler. So here's my diamond, here's my rock, and you will pay me the same for both. Well, it's not going to work. And the problem is that when freelancers set their fees, they tend to set their fees based on the amount of labor they're going to expend in order to render a service. So they base their fees on the input they will put into the service with an almost 100% disregard for the value the buyer gets out of the service. And where's the problem here? In the Communist Manifesto, Marx stated that profits are evil, unethical, and profits are really money that should be taken away from the sellers and should be given back to the buyers, and the buyer should distribute that money to the workers. So, because the workers are entitled to that, like Marx was a socialist, so in his eyes, every business person was evil, and all the money should be given to the workers. So that was an interesting theory, but in the long term, it turned out that, well, as we know, communism failed almost all over the world. So it's not a working business model. So why is this discussion? Many years ago, McKinsey and Company did a survey on how certain business maneuvers, business processes contribute to the bottom line of the business. And they found that 1% reduction in fixed costs can increase profits by 2.7%. 1 point increase in sales volume can increase profits by 3.7%. 1% reduction in variable costs can increase profits by 7%. But 1% increase in price can contribute as much as 11.7% to net profits. Yet, when you talk to most business people, most freelancers, and ask them what their biggest problems are. They say, I want more clients, I want more clients. But we've just seen that getting more clients, getting more sales volume, contributes just a tiny bit to the profit. But keeping the clients as they are, and they should take time to work on their prices, that could make a significant contribution to their prices, to their profits. And then in 2005, the professional consultant made a survey among freelancers and consultants, see how they charge, and it turns out that people, consultants who charge hourly rates, have 87% less profits than those consultants who charge a fixed fee for their work. It's significant, holy sausage, one would never believe that. But it is. So consultants who charge an hourly rate end up with 87% less profit than consultants who charge fixed fees. It's pretty significant. So that's why, instead of focusing on how we can get more clients, it's a good idea to look into how we price our services. But first we have to address some mental obstacles that can hold us back from raising our fees and prices. And I found six main reasons, although there are probably more. And one is that my clients can't afford higher fees because they just don't have money. And the interesting thing is they always have the money. A good few years ago, I made some interesting decisions, and as a result, I ended up homeless. Like, you know, many of you may have been broke. I was destitute, so living in a park for a couple of months. And then I managed to sneak into a homeless shelter. These are the really, how shall I say, newly released convicts, drug addicts, all these interesting people. What they had in common was that they were dead flat broke, chronically dead flat broke. Yet, they had a healthy supply of drugs, cigarettes, and booze. Okay, they may have stolen some, but I dare to bet some vital parts of my anatomy that they also purchased some of their stuff. So, we know the dough is available. What may not be available is the priority. So we just have to catch the buyer on his bullshit that, you know what, is it really that you don't have the money, or is this just not priority? So let's come clean and let's go home and end it here. The other reason is I wouldn't pay more if I were the buyer. Well, but I'm not the buyer. The buyer is the buyer, so it would be a mistake to make that kind of assumption. I have nothing special to offer. We all do. We all have special fragments of bits and bobs accumulated between our ears, which we can offer to specific target markets. And that's not school-related, not age-related. We all have something special to offer. It's just a matter of packaging it in such a way that it's sellable. Mine is a poor industry. How do we know? At the same time, the interesting thing is when some buyers say that, you know, I don't really have money for that. Tapping on the desk with his Porsche keys. You know, I don't have the money. Nah. Or, I just started in business, right? When we started in business, it doesn't make a dicky bird of a difference. We have the knowledge regardless of when we started. So even if we started yesterday, today we have the right to charge full price for our services. And the real cause, this is the real McCoy, really. I don't deserve it. Because I think, and I think Howard can confirm it, that having done so much training he's done, that we all have this mental limitation that We don't deserve it. We don't deserve it. And we just have to fight it that it's not whether or not we deserve it. This is the value we contribute to the client's business, and we want to be compensated accordingly. But the other problem is that often buyers regard freelancers as fungible vendors, as opposed to respectful experts. And in a way, it comes down to our marketing, that we have to create a presence for ourselves, and we have to, through marketing, we can create a gravity that instead of running after clients, they come to us that, hey, we've heard you are incredibly good. We've heard you are nipple-piercingly expensive, and we've heard that you are worth every penny. When can we start? So that's a lot easier than running after a client that, hey, we are good and we can give you a good discount. Like, at that point, the discount doesn't make any difference, not a sausage. So, and the other problem is the language. Whatever, for example, if I'm in a technology business, I understand the technology lingo, but the buyer is looking for a business solution, not a technical solution. So it's important that I speak the kind of English that the executives speak in the boardroom. So I have to teach my server room English, and I have to start talking boardroom English, because there's a significant difference between the two. And when we can talk about business outcomes and business results as opposed to bits and bytes, then we come across as credible peers, respected experts. But if we can't do that, the problem is that buyers end up relegating us to training managers, purchasing agents, HR goons, and various miscellaneous, self-important flunkies, really, who can't really make a decision, but can make opinions. But that's, from our perspective, that's roughly as useful as a cat flap on the elephant house, so we don't get far with them. So we have to start with how to screen out buyers. And again, that takes us back to our marketing, that how our marketing materials speak to buyers. And that way we can make sure that certain people contact us and certain people run away from us. So it's important that you develop a perfect client profile. And for my clients, I like breaking it down to three areas. The perfect buyer, the person I'm interacting with, the person who writes the check or I have the relationship with, the perfect company, and the perfect project, and all the details for that. So when we have these, when we clarify these three factors for ourselves, then we create our marketing messages accordingly, so it will resonate with certain people, and with certain people, well, it won't resonate, and they just declare us as idiots and run away very fast and very far, which is good. So, as freelancers, we get hired because we are expected to create value for the client, so nobody wakes us in the morning that, well, it's time to hire 10 hours of internet coding. Client wakes up that I've got this e-commerce site that is capable of producing $10,000 a day in sales, and it's down. And every minute I'm hesitating, I'm losing money. I need someone to fix this yesterday. And that's the value. So when we talk to the buyer, we can establish that value, and we will talk about it. So the value has three main ingredients: that how much value we are expected to create as freelancers, how fast, and with how much certainty. And all these little ingredients add to the value. So how much value do you propose to add? to our business, and how quickly do you propose to do it, and how certain are you that you can pull it off? And again, I just use Howard as an example. Over the years in business, he can tell the buyer that as a result of using my training courses, participating in my training courses, the average participant can increase his annual sales by 37%. Now, that's something specific, and the buyer says that, you know, I like it. Okay, let's do it. Now, there is no certainty, because in this world, there are no certainties except death and taxes. And as a former grave digger, I can confirm the former. As a current taxpayer, I can confirm the latter. But what we can do as freelancers, we put the client on the trajectory of achieving certain objectives. And depending on what they want to achieve, they have to invest differently. So what happens is when we sit down with the buyer, conventional wisdom says that, let's talk about me, I started the business X years ago, I got a triple MBA, I'm a certified chimney sweeper and all that. But that's irrelevant really, because we want to find out what the buyer wants to achieve. So what are the objectives the buyer wants to achieve? And then let's say the buyer says that, you know, we want to build a website. And then you can say, what organizational goal does this objective contribute to? And well, our strategic goal for 2011 is to increase our sales by 68%. Okay, what is it now? What will it be after the 68% increase as a target? So you start collecting numbers, and as you pile up the numbers, now you have something to project your fees later on. So you collect the objectives, what exactly the buyer wants to achieve by having you on board, and then you can ask the buyer about the metrics. And oh, by the way, I've got it nicely typed up, so somehow I can get these notes to you. And then, so you want to establish the metrics for the project. What metrics do you want to follow to keep the project on track? So that's important. And what obstacles does the buyer perceive that can get in the way of achieving all this? Because there's a strong likelihood that the client has already done something similar before, and he knows what obstacles got in the way previously. So he can say that, well, you know, it sounds interesting, but there's a strong likelihood that the operations manager in whatever department will try to sabotage the project. And then you can take contingency action that, then what do you plan to do with the operations manager? Are you going to set your mother-in-law in him, on him, or are you going to shoot him? So some options have to be worked out. So now we've got the potential obstacles. But now the good thing is that the buyer knows that this project is not going to be smooth as a baby's ass. There will be potential obstacles along the way. And as the top dog, he has to be ready for that. And then we can establish the value. And for establishing the value, I don't know much about jewelry. I don't wear any. I used to wear my engagement ring for about 5 minutes. And in my teens, I had a watch for about 2 months. But that's all. But we can use the example of a diamond. Someone told me that the value of a diamond depends on how many facets the diamond has. And when we look at a project, we can use that theory that, let's see, the buyer has, I don't know if I, well, let's see, we can use that if I get kicked in the shins rather harshly. So, it's all good.
That's all right.
Holy sausage, man. Things are falling apart. Well, part of life. So, basically, you will see when you get the notes, the buyer has a problem, but the problem is that what the buyer thinks the problem is really a symptom. So there are underlying issues. So let's say the buyer says that IT problem, the system crashes extensively, too often. Okay. What can cause that, and what are the effects of this system crash? That there are effects like, and this is where we play around with this facet thing, that stressed out computer operators. Now, these computer operators are paid. There's a certain downtime associated with the crashes. How much money the company is losing by the operators are just standing by waiting for the reboot. So that's one facet. It's all can be quantified. Frustrated employees stay home sick because, you know what, that system will keep crashing. I just stay at home and phone in. I'm sick and I just use my medical leave. And the problem is the best of the best employees just pack up and go over to the competition. So that increases attrition. Production downtime, that's obvious as a ham sandwich. And increased management attention on issues that don't really belong to management, because these issues shouldn't come up. That system should be operational in a fairly reliable way. And delays in order deliveries. And that can cause customer attrition. And all this can be quantified. And now the soft impact, compromised brand, because now your company is unreliable. Marketplace perceives the leadership as a bunch of idiots. The investors community, attention goes to the investors community. Hey guys, don't invest with this company because they are the bunch of third-rate punks and they don't know what they are doing. So all these things can be quantified, and now we have the value of the problem we are addressing, and then when, let's say, talking about an IT problem, that's when you can tell the buyer, you've got this problem. What I suggest is we can do a diagnostics on your situation, on what's happening. But it's not free consulting, it's a paid diagnostic. So, but still, if you say that, look, you've got a problem that is, let's say, $5 million on an annual basis. Based on that, can you justify an inexpensive $10,000-$15,000 diagnostic project to diagnose what's wrong actually with your server? So $4 million and $15,000, there's a huge gap. So the client, if he's got more than two brain cells, will see that there is massive value. For $15,000, these guys will diagnose what causes this $4 million problem. And the good thing is that instead of The conventional wisdom would say that try to expand the sale, try to sell a bigger project, you deliberately try to reduce the sale. Look, we've never worked together. Let's start small, because we may end up hating each other's guts. And this has to work on a personal basis. Remember, Howard pointed it out at the sales workshop upstairs, that we have to click on a personal level, and only then we can do business. And then what happens is, when you establish your value, then what you can say is that on an annual basis, this problem is costing you so much. And what you can do, since the client is likely to be in the business for 5 years from now, you can take that annualized value out for 5 years. So now we are X, 5X, and you can add to this hard value, you can add an extra 15-20% for the soft value, better brand recognition, better teamwork and all that. So what happens in the company when this problem is addressed and resolved properly? Now you have a number which you can play with. And if you say that, like, I like offering clients a 10-to-1 return on their investment, so based on what you've told me, in 5 years, this is what it would cost you. And this is how much you have to invest to resolve this problem. And based on that, you can offer the client a proposal with 3 options. Because the interesting thing is that if you just tell clients that, look, this is how much, it's a yes-no decision. But if you offer clients a couple of options, and allegedly 3 is the ideal psychologically, options empower people because they know they have a choice. It's up to them. But now the good thing is that instead of giving you a yes or no answer, now the question is, okay, which one? And on your proposals, you can outline the value items the client gets from different options. So what happens is that psychologically, almost nobody takes the lowest option. Yeah, almost nobody. And small number of clients take the highest option, but most clients take the medium option. And you can set up the options in such a way that they represent tremendous value to the buyer, but they are not labor intensive for you. So at this moment, you've totally detached your input, the how much you work and how much value you create. Because you've just re-educated the buyer that you don't pay me for the number of hours I perform manual labor. You make an investment in a brighter future. And it sounds differently, and it's perceived differently. And I just use using the example Ford versus Ferrari. You can buy a Ford for 20 grand and a Ferrari for $500,000. But that's a perception. When it comes to manufacturing the two cars, there's not that much difference. Maybe a Ferrari costs twice as much to manufacture, or 3 times, because it's largely handmade. But not 20 times. So that's what we have to achieve in our pricing, that buyers have to see the value they get out of our contribution. After all, we are knowledge workers. As one of the presenters, was it Howard or someone else, pointed out, that we sell results. How we get there, it's irrelevant. If you can create significant results for the buyers, for the buyer by standing on your head for 10 minutes. Hey, stand on your head for 10 minutes. Ask the buyer to write you a check for $100,000 and Bob's your uncle. Phew, off you go home. You made a good bob on the project and the buyer is happy because the problem has been solved. So this is essentially, and what can help a little bit is some pricing remedies. You may have experienced that certain buyers try to sort of, I don't have better words, so I use the word intimidate you, that, look, I represent this company, you dirty little freelancer, let me tell you about it. And that's the point, because they try to regard you as a fungible vendor. Okay, if I push her around a little bit, she will cave in on the price and all that. That's when you can add a little arrogance to your attitude, that, you know what, I guess this is not going to work out. I guess we found the reason for not working together, so let's just go home and leave it at that point. And this is where it all depends on your style, on your values, that, you know, if you are by nature sort of softer person, you may use softer words. If you are a kind of more of a hard ass, you may use more of a hard assish words. But I find when I say that, you know what, I don't think this is going to work out, so let's just go home. It's a sort of natural, it's sort of unbiased, that or the other expression I've used, I've heard from Mahan Kasa, he wrote a book a number of years ago, Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play, brilliant. And he said that it seems we've hit a yellow light. Shall we try to turn it into green, or just shall we call it red and end it here? And clients can't take it personally because you've just said that it seems we don't have a mutually beneficial basis for working together, so we can just all go home.
You need to find your values before you just decide to be walk away from the project?
Basically, you've already sort of built up the value. You know, remember, we talked about this diamond thing, that with each point, and when you said that, when you say, make a statement about one certain facet of the diamond, and you tell the client, am I right? And the buyer says, okay, then I'd like to ask you to do something. Grab your calculator and punch it out on the calculator. Because now, you don't do it for the buyer, you involve the buyer, you do it. You punch it out on the calculator and you will see the number. And when the buyer sees the number on the calculator, that, holy Toledo Batman, I've never thought it was so bad. And when you do that, we, for each value component, this diamond thing, then the buyer will see that, wow, when I add this all up, it adds up to this. Okay, and this is this is on an annual basis. And if this goes on, it just goes on and on and on, year after year. So conventional sales wisdom says that always be closing, but I think it's a lot better if we are on this always be leaving track, that look, I'm looking for a reason not to do business, and the sooner we find it, the sooner we can go home and have lunch. And some buyers will take it as arrogance, but I believe real buyers who treat you as a peer with brutal honesty. There's a book out there called Radical Honesty. If you have a chance, read it. Brilliant. If you treat each other with radical honesty, then it's just a statement, and it's totally neutral.
You have 10
minutes. Oh, thank you. So basically, that was it in a nutshell, And then if you have questions, we can debate and argue and wrestle and do interesting things about questions.
Yeah. What about retainer fees? What is your take on that?
That's an interesting thing, because for most people, retainers mean a prepaid number of hours of manual labor. But my idea about retainers is that for retainers, there is no project. There are no metrics. There is nothing. You are available to answer occasional questions. And you are not on call that they can call you 24/7. They can call you and you get back to the buyer. But in a way, a retainer works like a library. You can go to the library when you have a problem. You can ask questions, and the librarians help you out. But the library staff is not going to chase you. Hey, do you have questions? Do you have questions? So this is the same thing with retainers. You are available to answer questions. You are you are available with your two cents for the buyer as a second pair of eyes, but you are not involved in any project in any which way. Because it's just a lighter engagement, because the traditional retainer engagement is really just normal project work.
So just advice and counsel. And then if the client said, based on your advice and counsel, we should do this thing.
Yes.
You see that on a project basis.
Yes, exactly. That's when the retainer turns into a proper project. And then for that, you establish the objectives, the metrics, and the value, and then you price it out accordingly. So
what do you think of fixed rates versus commission?
If you have a chance to read Dan Pink's new book, Drive, he's done extensive research on that performance-based payment is a losing deal. One way not to get peak performance out of people is to pay them for performance, because it's demotivating, it makes people to focus on long-term, flash-in-the-pan improvements at the expense of long-term improvements. So also, if the buyer insists, if it is the kind of project that kind of project for which commissions are used, you still can insist that, okay, we can do part of it, but I still require this chunk as a fixed fee. Because what happens is when there is no investment, in my opinion, there is no commitment. And if there is no commitment, nothing will happen. And at the end of the day, the client comes back that, you're an idiot, you didn't deliver what you promised. What do you mean? Oh, you said you will write a web page that will increase our subscribers. Let's look at the web page. Here it is. I didn't write this. Yeah, because you wrote that letter and I gave it to my son who's got a PhD in English and he rewrote it. Has he done copywriting? No, but any idiot can write copy. Well, obviously, and you are one and your son is the other. So definitely there are two idiots in the equation. So give me my money or I kick you in the shins. Because you violated the contract. You hired me for something and basically you overwrote my letter. So that's why I believe it's important the client makes an investment in whatever way it is. And also, I think the best bet is to avoid the commission structure totally, because when you get paid, you get paid for your objectivity. Whereas if money is on the line, your objectivity goes down the toilet, because now you focus on keeping your commission, earning your commission, no matter what. And that's when shortcuttings can come into the equation. And I think one big value clients get out of your contribution is your objectivity, that you are willing to be the terse but loving parent to the client, that, look, I like you, I respect you, but this copy on your website is rubbish. I'm not criticizing you, I'm not criticizing the person who wrote it. This is my objective opinion about this copy on the website. And the problem is, if you were paid on a commission basis and the client could say that, you know what, you're an idiot, get out of here. And I think this is the reason why, for example, counselors or therapists don't do this commission deal. Although many times the issue with which people go to therapists is business-related issue. Yes?
Do you have any information, or can you direct us anywhere that would have like a formula or some sort of metrics of what to charge for a service? Not specifically what to charge, but how to break down, like I'm a filmmaker, I can make videos, but there's not a website that I know of that can go and see what those numbers are, what that value is. I'm making it up myself. So if I'm making it up myself, what are some tools I could use, some ideas like that, how you can sort that out?
I've got a monthly newsletter where we talk about this value stuff and all aspects of freelancing stuff. So, and instead of the newsletter with the short articles, every month I go deep into one aspect of it, deep like 3,000-5,000 words. So it's sort of details that can be an option. And when I can send Mina the notes and she can send it out to people, and then I put some resources on it, because I've got some.
Would you suggest maybe I would just connect with others and do the same thing, ask them? Is that
That can be an option, and there's a meetup group for consultants, especially, and that can be a good connection. Because just like most freelancers, you don't really have a thing to sell. You sell a specific result that, when with a good video, the client looks like $1 million. With a bad video, the client looks like a punk. Yeah. So it can destroy the brand. So
would you also suggest that, you know, looking at and getting the information that what others are doing is something you should base what you do on?
Oh, get the information and just look at it, but you don't necessarily have to base your methodology, your way of charging on that, because I think Earl Nightingale is totally right when he says that most people are going in the wrong direction, and if you want to succeed in life, look at your industry and do the total opposite.
Okay.
And I think that can be a point. Yes.
I still, you know, in shock over the statistic about fixed rate versus hourly rate. And I'm wondering how, where this number comes from, the 80%, 87%.
And the professional consultant is a reputable magazine for the consulting industry, and they did it, and some companies that were involved in the research are McKinsey, Booz Allen, and I think the Boston Consulting Group.
So you think they're talking to a lot of like small business and real entrepreneurial consultants, or do you think they're just talking with big level guys doing big consulting?
I believe
McKinsey, you know, it's big business stuff.
Yeah. So that people who charge a flat fee as opposed to an hourly rate can make 87% higher profits. And I'm just thinking that even if it is not 87%, let it be 57, it's still, if we use it as a guideline, or let's forget about the number and just say that people who charge a flat rate make significantly more than an hourly the significant hurt is good enough for me. And actually, big consulting firms love doing that. That they come in on a bid. Hey, we charge so much per hour. Wow, you are the lowest. That's brilliant. We hire you. And next morning, an army of freshly minted MBAs descend on the company. They charge a competitive hourly rate, but they make up on volume because now you've got a university full of greenhorns learning the profession on the client's dime. So, okay, we charge only $100 an hour and we send 120 people on you and try to manage them.
3 minutes, and then you're done.
Yes.
Can I just give a few minutes to you, the website or part of the Pittsburgh, and read some more on that?
Yeah, it's DI-Squad, Dynamic Innovation Squad.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And if you do get a fixed rate, what are your suggestions on making them pay, for instance, you ask for 50 up front and then 25 for the
50-50. So I ask 50 up front and the other 50 is about 30 or 45 days later. And never need a penny to completion because clients tend to stretch out the completion day. So when your money is on the line, clients are not really interested in completing the project because, hey, let's do this, do that. No, according to the agreement, this. Well, then we don't pay you. But if you have, so make sure that by halfway of the project, your money is fully collected.
So wouldn't the client not want to be involved with you if they know that they're paid, like, that you will have all the money and haven't delivered all the services?
Then it's probably a trust issue and just kick out the client. It's just aggravation, just, you know, it would stress you out, and then, you know, you don't need these idiots who don't trust you. If they don't trust you, why did they hire you in the first place? And it's a bit harsh, and it may not work for everyone, but knowing that I ended up where I ended on the streets because I tried to be a nice guy. And then someone decided to get the upper hand on me, and it went a bit rough. So
could you maybe exchange the word completion to delivery? And would that work in your theory or not?
It can be. Can be.
Would you do that? No.
It depends. If it is the kind of project that it's sort of one-sided, you do the work for the client, then you can fiddle with it. But with a real consulting project, it's a true collaboration. That it's not that you do it for the client, you do it with the client. It's like lovemaking. You don't do it to people, you do it with people.
Thank you, guys. I think it's a big deal.